The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Max Rushton. Welcome to Football Weekly Extra. The Thursday edition is never quite as good as the Monday. But if you follow this advice from someone who goes by the name of David Wheater's Chin on the blog, he says, in fairness, I don't mind Max. Listening to him on here reminds me of watching the Carling Cup. You know it's inferior to other competitions, i.e. Jimbo, but if you lower your expectations somewhat, you're not disappointed. So if we all think of today's pod as a kind of Carling Cup, or maybe like Simod Cup, or a Freight Rover Trophy, hopefully we'll all have a nice time. Today we will discuss the following. Arsenal lose 4-0 in Milan. Is this A, just one bad result, B, the latest in a long run of bad results, or C, a complete disaster? Just what has gone wrong at Rangers, and is this the beginning of the end of Scottish football? Also, the Bundesliga, Sid in Spain, and Carlos Tevez on the art of diplomacy. Paul McInnes is here. Morning.
Hiya.
How are you? Well,
no, I'm dandy, thank you very much. I've got my Paul Lambert t-shirt on.
Looking at fashion, I was saying James Horncastle is here as well. First time we've met. You well?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm wearing a chunky knit.
The most debonair.
With elbow pads. So,
and some
just in case.
Some mustard suede shoes as well.
Yes, indeed. They've been a bit spoiled. I didn't Scotch guard them. So actually, I got them wet in Milan, so they're probably spoiled. That's why I'm wearing. Anyway, needless anecdote.
No, it's like, well, we'll keep it in, depending on how well the rest of the pod goes. And Rafa Honigstein is here. You well?
Very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Just so you know, producer Ben has put a singing ban on today's pod after, on Monday, Fernando and I finished it with more than words, which is why I'm a bit croaky today. Right, well, let's start with the Arsenal game. 4-0 loss in Milan. Arsene Wenger didn't even really put up a defence last night, just said it was terrible. How bad was it? Rafa?
Indefensible. On and off the pitch. It was pretty shocking, but I guess the most shocking thing of all was that it didn't come as such a surprise. I mean, Arsenal, throughout the last few years, have always been outclassed to various degrees. I think they deluded themselves into believing they were quite close to Barcelona last year, and if it hadn't been for Van Persie, etc., etc. But the year before they were destroyed, the year before that they were completely outplayed by United. So it's not, you know, it's not a jolt from the blue. And if you look at their league form, of course, you could make an argument that this is really the worst Arsenal team ever under Wenger's reign.
Yeah, I think what I would say, as per it being a surprise, was that when the draw was made, the Italians were kind of cautiously optimistic that they have this hoodoo against English teams of late. I think in the last 4 years of the Champions League, they've been knocked out 7 times in the 8 occasions they've met an English side. And Milan went out to Arsenal in 2008. But that cautious optimism sort of dissipates certainly through into the new year, because Milan were on a terrible run of form. They had a horrendous injury crisis. I think against Udinese on Saturday, they had 10 players out, and it was their first win in 4 games. And that was a very poor performance as well. So last night was a bit of a shock, for not so much that they won, but certainly the how emphatic it was. Coming back from injury of Boateng, Robinho, Van Bommel back from suspension, Ibrahimovic rested because he didn't play at the weekend because he'd got sent off the weekend before, was very key. But I think that was certainly probably the best performance Milan have given, not just this season, but under Allegri since he's been there for, what, 1.5 seasons now.
I think. I mean, I've been an occasional ESPN watcher of Serie A on a Saturday night, and I've seen Milan play very well in Serie A this season. And kind of that situation where they play 15, 20 minutes just perched on the edge of somebody's box. Mm. And there wasn't so much of that last night. I thought they didn't look as dynamic as I expected them to. I don't go for all that Ibra was marvellous and changed our opinion of him. I thought he did a good job, but not an outstanding one. I just thought Arsenal were pathetic. Arsenal had no impetus, no leadership, no drive, no organisation. And it was like at least 4 or 5 of these players thought before the game, well,
and it's basically the same Milan team that Spurs knocked out last year, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that they've been criticised heavily for is that since Allegri's been at the club, they've sort of rid the team of any sort of creativity of a playmaker as such. You know, they've got rid of Ronaldinho, they got rid of Pirlo in the summer, something that was really strongly sort of doubted. Corriere della Sera last week kind of likened it to getting rid of architects like Pirlo and bringing in carpenters like Van Bommel. So when certain players haven't been in the team, namely Boateng, they've looked really one-dimensional. You know, they've had to go to Ibra to win games, and to his credit, he can often pull teams on the team on his back and carry them to victory on his own. He's nicknamed Gulliver at the moment in time in Italy because he's a giant in that sense. But I agree. I think Arsenal offered very, very little, and Wenger has to take a look at himself, because I think regardless of how Arsenal came into this game, they were still a team that could certainly pose Milan problems. Milan don't have particularly problems with pace, but width, essentially. And I think if Walcott and, say, if he'd started Oxlade-Chamberlain on either side, they could have caused some real damage there. Instead, you know, half-time Walcott, completely anonymous, taken off, Henri thrown on, but then you've got Ramsey and Rosicki on either side of midfield.
Why hasn't... this question's been asked so many times, but why hasn't Wenger invested? And will he look at this now and go, actually, at the end of the season, I will buy some players?
Well, he's actually bought a few players. It's just that the quality has been diminishing over the years. He's losing his best players every year, and the players he's bringing in always the players who need 2-3 more years to become a really good player, by which time the other good players are about to leave again. So it's a continuous evolution without ever really anyone.
But is that because he can't
getting
afford?
Anywhere?
Nobody knows, do they? The thing about the kind of the workings of Arsenal Football Club and how much money they actually have is a mystery, and people don't know. And you look at what they've done, and you suspect that he doesn't have as much money as he says he does. But I think that question, the point you're making there about the 2 or 3 years, I think what we're seeing right now is actually, even after that 2 or 3 years, are those players definitely going to develop? Some do, like Cesc, but you're looking at Walcott now. I've got a soft spot for Theo, but you look at him now and you think, this season has not been a good season for you. You just haven't had a good enough game. You haven't had enough good games. Aaron Ramsey now is looking like he's slipping backwards rather than going forwards.
Although he's playing too many games, which is not...
Well, sure, but he's got to, you know, because he's got talent and they need him in the middle of the park. And then, you know, you've got nobody in that squad right now who's going to take that team on.
Well, I mean, I
no
think
leadership.
Wilshere, his injury has been... It's perhaps one of those young players who was highly touted as being someone who could take that team on, but I mean his being out for the entire season effectively perhaps shows that Wenger has lost. So why Wenger doesn't have a comparable player, because I mean this time last year I think against Barcelona their midfield was what, Nasri, Fabregas and Wilshere. You look at it last night, Rosicky, Ramsey, Arteta and Song.
I mean, Song. I think Song is up. Song is a good player, and I think he would play in a good Arsenal side.
He was named Arsenal's best player in Gazetta this morning, which I think was wrong, because I think.
But did any of them have? I thought Oxlade-Chamberlain looked like the sparkiest, and he has done for the
still
last.
Still never beat his man, though, did he?
I think. I thought Song didn't know, and to some extent, they couldn't cope with Ibrahimovic, in the sense that Ibrahimovic is, as he's done so often for Milan this year, he comes so deep that he's effectively their number 10 deep lying playmaker, as well as a finisher, as a striker at the same time. He's very, very difficult to pick up, and I think Vermaelen and Song didn't know what to do. Should I stand off? Should I go with him? And it wreaked havoc.
That for me was the most interesting thing, because I thought it was a very Milan-like performance, in a sense that they didn't really look that convincing in the middle of the park. The fullbacks, I don't think, ever ventured forward once in that game. So it wasn't as if they're sort of swamping Arsenal and really dominating the game, but the movement of the three guys up front and just as sort of the kind of streetwise ability to create things out of almost out of nothing was too much for the back four and for Song, who was completely conspicuous by his absence, I should say. So that was quite interesting, because in the past, when Milan or other Italian teams have tried to sort of play their Serie A style in the Champions League, they were overwhelmed by the pace, by the sort of ferocity of English teams, and they couldn't deal with that. And this time, they slowed the game down to a level where they're very happy with, and still had too much for Arsenal.
I mean, so it's been a pretty terrible Champions League for English sides. One side left in it, basically. Now, Chelsea, who are at Napoli next week. James, Napoli are seventh, have only won three of their last 10. Chelsea, fifth in the Premier League, only won two of their last 10. So both of these sides aren't really any good.
No, you never know what you're going to get. But at the same time, with Napoli, I think perhaps last year they overperformed. They exceeded expectations. No one expected Cavani to have the season that he did. And the coach, Walter Mazzarri, he's been in charge for 2 years now. I think the novelty of his system, 3-4-2-1, has not worn off in Serie A, but teams have grown used to playing Napoli. They've adapted now. You see a lot of teams matching them up, like for like formation wise, going 3-5-2 or whatnot. But there is still this sense that teams, especially in Europe, as City have found, as Bayern to some extent have found, still, they're not used to playing teams like Napoli. They do have something different. And in Italy, they're sort of billing them as this... they're likening them to Benitez's Liverpool, in that they're a very formidable side in a knockout situation. No one would like to play them, because they've got players and a system which can, especially on the counter-attack, can beat anyone, you know.
So they're more up for it in the Champions League as well, it seems.
Yeah, I think the league they've recognised is not so much been beyond them for some time now, but I think they are genuinely focusing on this cup competition as being, and also the Coppa Italia, as being something that, you know, they can genuinely. I don't think they have aspirations to win the Champions League, but for prestige sake, they take it extremely seriously. They're not a team that, I mean, obviously they got through the group stages, but they're not a team that are prepared to write it off in the hope of going on to make the qualify for next year's Champions League.
So who's going to go through then, Chelsea or Napoli, in a word?
I would say Napoli, just because I think they have an identity. They have a clear identity. Everyone knows what they've got to do. Whereas at Chelsea, there are certain people, you know, pulling each other apart. If you know, there's a big transition period going on there still, and so you know, I would probably go with Napoli.
Paul,
yeah, Napoli. I think I just, you know, Chelsea look too porous at the minute.
I go with Chelsea.
Right, welcome back to part two of Football Weekly Extra. Let's start this bit by talking about Rangers. The Guardian's Scottish football reporter is Ewan Murray. Hi, Ewan.
Morning, how are you?
I'm very well. Producer Ben this morning was telling me that we only talk to you when there's bad news.
Correct, absolutely correct.
I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
So why has it happened then, Ewan?
Well, there are two strands to this, Max, which I think need to be pointed out as kind of separate. There is the... what became a perilous state for Rangers because of David Murray's management of the club. They ended up in the grip of Lloyds Bank and subsequently ended up under investigation by the tax authorities because of an employee benefit trust scheme, basically a loophole to pay players dating back to 2000. Now that still was yet to be decided, although the tribunal in that has concluded, but Rangers are yet to be hit with a bill which could be, we reckon, upwards of £40 million. Now that is strand A. Strand B is the ownership of Rangers under Craig White since May of last year. Now, what happened on Tuesday when Rangers went into administration is the HMRC confirmed they were pursuing Rangers for £9 million of PAYE, I can never say that, and VAT, dating back to when White took over the club. So it's a horrible situation for Rangers, a real messy situation. But as I said, there are these two strands which I think people, they are linked, because Rangers were in such a desperate state that the bank controlled them and the bank wanted rid of them and Craig White took over. But there are, to me, there are quite clear and separate aspects to the Rangers situation.
Is this specifically, I mean, obviously this is clearly about Rangers, but is this a problem for the whole of Scottish football?
Well, potentially. I mean, the thing with this story is we're continually talking about hypothetical situations and what could happen and what might happen. As it stands, Rangers are administration, so they get hit with a 10-point penalty. Now, if they just come out of that, if they agree a CVA and come out of administration, you know, it's going to be pretty hard there. It'll be tough. There'll be redundancies, etc., and the other horrible things that go with that. But that, in a football sense, would be the end of it. The complication comes in if Rangers, you know, are liquidated and have to reform as a separate company. Then there's an issue about them getting back into the SPL. Would clubs allow them back into the SPL, which is offset. You have to offset the commercial reality and impact of Rangers, which can't be ignored, against what people would regard as financial fair play. And at that point, it becomes a real political hot potato and really complicated. And that, we can't hide from the fact that that could yet happen.
Paul? Two things, really. First of all, I'm wondering, where did the rot set in? And was it when Scottish football was maybe struggling to kind of pull in the sort of names that they had been used to over the previous decade and had to overspend on wages? And secondly, if Rangers goes into liquidation and reforms as a new football club, could it start in the English League?
I'll take the second point first. Almost certainly no, although I dare say, I mean, that has been suggested, and I dare say people would be quite keen for that to happen, but UEFA, for one, I'm sure would have something to say about that. That's, again, an extension of a hypothetical argument. I don't see that happening. I've never really seen that happening. But, Paul, of course, some people would want that to happen. Mm. Your first point, Rangers are an exception to that, of course, because when Graeme Souness arrived at Ibrox in the 80s, they spent lavishly back then, and really, you know, they would argue boosted Scottish football's profile and lifted the game up. Others would argue their spending at that point ruined Scottish football to an extent because it left the others behind, and clubs have never really caught up, you know, from back then, the odd flirtation from other clubs aside. So that being linked to clubs like Motherwell and Kilmarnock, who had their spells of overspending and going heavily into debt, that's different from the Rangers situation just because of when Rangers did it. But essentially, yes, I mean, the root of their problem was that David Murray, not through badness, I don't think, but arguably through recklessness, chased a dream which was in Europe. By spending too much money, Rangers ended up, I think, at their peak, around £80 million in debt.
Yeah, they spent £82 million in 3.5 years.
Yeah, I mean, £12 million on Flo is the one which is highlighted as the epitome of that. But they through that, and through Murray's own business strategy, which was always high debt, high turnover. So, of course, them in the banking, and listen, Rangers weren't anything like £80 million in debt when the banking crisis hit, but when it did, of course, all Murray's business affairs became really tightly in the grip of the bank, and Rangers got caught up in that. And the sooner that Rangers could be separated from Murray from that point, the better. And then this leads you on, as I said, to Craig White takes over, and a lot of, I would say, really questionable stuff has happened between May and now.
All right, yeah, well, hopefully we'll one day talk to you with some good news. I mean, it does mean that Motherwell could win the Champions League next year.
Well, this is another point, of course. If European licence matters aren't in place by the end of March, there's an impact on the team who finish, well, I think it will be third. I don't think anyone will catch Rangers, but the team who finish third in the SPL could have an extra European boost. So maybe that's the positive note to leave this on, if there is one in this.
Small bit of icing on a really rubbish cake. Right, well, cheers, Ewan. We'll speak to you again soon. Ewan Murray there, Guardian's Scottish football reporter. Right, let's move on to the Bundesliga. Rafa, you are the expert. I confess, when I used to live in Berlin back in 97, I used to go and watch Hertha Berlin when they had Brian Roy. I presume he's not still there. I know they're 15th, so they're not doing very well. But it's exciting at the top. There's 5 points separating the top four.
Yes, exciting at the top. And it is exciting at Hertha as well, because they fired Michael Skibber after 5 games only in charge. He lost all 5 of them.
But,
so
I mean,
that was the quickest...
Still, you need some time.
The quickest and worst sort of firefighting exercise you'll ever see. Already out of the job again. At the top, it is very interesting. And there is a sense, I think, that Gladbach are now firmly part of the title race after a fantastic performance against Schalke at the weekend. Schalke... still points-wise very much in it, but I think the way Gladbach played, the way that Bayern and Dortmund seem to get results even when they're not playing so well at the moment, those three look really, really good, and it's really, really exciting.
Is it the most competitive league in Europe? Because it's interesting, we were talking about Scotland and they say that's not competitive at all. But if City or Man City or Man United lost 10 points, they'd still be third in the Premier League. So it's worth thinking that. Is the Bundesliga the most competitive?
Well, if you look at the points at the very top, it is, yes. Bayern, for example, I think they've only once finished outside the top four in 20 years. So it shows you just... that they're a little bit in a league of their own, whereas everyone else is pretty competitive.
And the Sun says that Bayern may be buying Junior Hoylett.
Yeah.
Credence to that?
I don't know. I mean, they bought Dale Jennings, of course, where everyone thought this is a complete joke, but they did for the second team. So I don't know if they want to buy Junior Hoylett for the second team as well.
How's he doing, Dale Jennings?
He's not doing so great. He arrived and immediately found something wrong with his hip. He had some imbalance. He had surgery. His sort of...
Remind us who he is? I say remind me who he is.
He was like a little bit of a prodigy for Tranmere last season. He would pop up on the Football League show scoring crackers from 40 yards.
That's right.
Yeah, he scored two goals against MK Dons when Didi Hamann was playing there. And there's a suggestion that Hamann tipped off his mate Christian Erlinger, who suddenly showed a big interest in Dale Jennings. And yeah, the problem is that he came to Munich with disastrous fitness levels. They tested him and it was just didn't look very good. And then they found there was something wrong with his hip. And he's played a little bit, but he hasn't really done much.
I was once on a train to interview Didi Hamann, and I got to Stoke, and then the Stockport press officer rang. And Didi said, "I do not want him or anyone to do with that show, anyone near us." So we had to go and interview Paul Dickov instead in Oldham.
What had you done to poor Didi Hamann?
I don't know. I've never done anything to Didi Hamann. And then he came on the show, but only because Noel Gallagher and Stifler from American Pie were on. I don't think anything to do with me. But he seemed
Did you have dancing Didi men in the background or something, kind of humiliating the German?
That's not what our show's about. That's not, we're cleverer than that. No, actually, we're probably not, are we? finally, Dortmund's Shinji Kagawa. Is he going to Liverpool and would he be any use for them?
I think he'd be used at a lot of teams. He's been playing really, really well again. He got injured a year ago, broke his metatarsal, and it took him a bit of a time to come back. And he didn't quite do himself justice, along with the rest of his team, it should be said, in the Champions League. But he's now back to his best. Dortmund are back to their best. And he was someone who was very much linked with the move in the winter break. People kind of half expected Man United to make an offer because they had been looking at him in the past. Liverpool, I haven't heard about that one before, but I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of good teams looking at him, because not only is he a very good player, but you have the whole Japanese merchandising marketing dimension, which is very important, unfortunately, even if it shouldn't be.
And finally, Bayern tried a PR coup, which turned into a complete disaster on Facebook. What happened?
Yes, they did. Well, it was just one of those ideas that perhaps looked good at the time, but it should have never looked good at any time. The idea was to suggest that they've made a really important signing, a new star, and they've asked you to log on to a Facebook page, and then the application was done in a way that you, the person who's logging on, is being seen as a new star in a press conference. So they turn over a little page and they show, this is the new signing. You are 12th man. You're really important. So, I mean, that by itself is naff.
It's terrible, isn't it? Anybody who likes football would just hate that.
That by itself is very naff and in bad taste. However, it was made worse by an official kind of press release on their website saying that they would announce a new signing. And everyone went mad. This was in the winter break. And they even quoted a real quote from Uli Hoeneß saying, we need a new player, so we really need to strengthen. So people are really, really excited, to the point that some of the players, I know this, were upset because no one had told them
who it was or anything.
Yeah, and Mario Gomez allegedly, but I say this with on good authority, was having a really bad day because he thought that they'd bought another striker. Of course they didn't. They didn't.
Only two goals every game, not enough.
They didn't. So it was a terrible own goal.
You'd love to be at that meeting of how many people saying this would be a great idea and our fans would love
this. The guy responsible did get a bit of a bollocking from upstairs. It wasn't good. Ironically, that whole fiasco might have just spurred them on a little bit to bring forward the signing of Sheridan Shaqiri, who'd have just announced now a week later. You know, he's somebody who's only coming in the summer, so the fact that they made a deal in February suggests to me that they wanted to change the atmosphere around the club a little.
Get anyone, just get any old player that's not.
And he's a very good player, and it is a good signing. I think the reaction of the fans also showed them that the fans kind of really expected someone to come in, that they weren't quite happy with Bayern not doing anything in the winter break. It's quite funny.
It's just the worst idea, yeah, I think I've ever heard a club doing. Well, I mean, there are probably worse ones, but they don't spring to mind. We're going to carry on talking about Germany, talk about Leverkusen against Barca, lost 3-1. Rafa, they scared them a little bit, didn't they?
Yeah, but the problem is that Leverkusen themselves were far too scared throughout the game to really do anything. And by the time they sort of snapped out of their respect or fear, whatever you want to call it, it was too late. I mean, they scared them, they scored the equaliser, but immediately conceded again. And it kind of summed up what Robin Dutt, the manager, said. You know, we gave them too much respect, but we actually played pretty well for 41 minutes, not conceding. Then when we looked a lot better, people thought it was more entertaining, we conceded two more goals. So it was almost like you'd damned if you do and you're damned if you don't defend. And the upshot was that Leverkusen were just in a different league, one or two leagues lower than Barcelona. And I think Dutt said that it'll take us a lifetime to make up the difference between us and them, which is fair. But the biggest fallout, as it were, wasn't so much a result, because it was kind of half expected even before the tie that Leverkusen would not be good enough, was that Manuel Friedrich and Kadlec, the goal scorer, both fought for Lionel Messi's shirt. So they got one each, one at half time and one at the final whistle. And this kind of summed up deference and being in awe of the opposition and perhaps not really thinking or believing that they could beat them. It was taken as a sign that they weren't perhaps really concentrating on the real thing, but thinking about Lionel Messi's shirt a little bit too much. And Föller, the sporting director, made sure now in an announcement today that they would both have to auction their shirts off for charity, because he was upset as well.
See, I would definitely wait for the second leg and get the home shirt, because that pistachio one is just, it's horrible, isn't it? Doesn't make you got Messi's one, it's just a horrible shirt. Well, we can talk to Sid Lowe in Spain. Hi, Sid, you well?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Would you say what Rafa said is true, that in the Champions League, Barcelona will play teams that give them so much respect, more so than in La Liga, that gives them, you know, this route to the final?
I think one of the key things isn't so much that as the sort of the immediacy of the targets. You know, I think that Barcelona, it's difficult to motivate yourself for a league title, which is 15, 20, or even obviously at the start of the season, 38 games away. Whereas the Champions League, because you're always on the verge of a knockout, I think it's as much as anything else, I think it's about Barcelona's attitude going to the Champions League as much as about their opponent's attitudes. And I think that really is the key. That has just bought me her fluffy toy. Hang on, and get rid of her. I think that's more important than the way that the teams approach them. I think in Spain this year, if you look at the way that Barcelona have been beaten, it's not necessarily because teams have failed to show them respect or that teams have really gone for them. It's more, I think, a combination of other factors. Motivation is one of them. The physical condition of them is one of them. But one of them certainly is that every other team in Spain now has got a very clear idea of what Barcelona are.
It looked to me like you could scare them, though. I mean, Leverkusen, if you sort of hit them hard and, you know, pump a few balls into their box, they don't really
it. This is one of the things that's changed in Spain is that, you know, it used to be that everybody thought, right, well, Barcelona are going to dominate possession. They're going to create loads of chances. The best thing to do is protect ourselves. And I think teams have learned that if you just sit and wait for Barcelona, it may well take 85 minutes, but they'll eventually get through you. So teams are starting to learn to step up a little bit further, to put pressure on the few players who are less comfortable in possession, which, in other words, there's no point in putting pressure on the midfielders. You need to put it higher up the pitch. And the Barcelona can be got at, and they are a little bit more vulnerable. Because if you're going to make the assumption, Barcelona are going to have possession, therefore let's let them have possession. Ultimately, it may look like it's harder for them to break you down, and Inter Milan showed this, for example, and one or two other teams have shown this in draws against Barcelona and victories against them. But generally speaking, if you wait for them, they will eventually turn up.
I think you said on Monday that Messi's looking a bit tired. He didn't at all. Is he just a perfect example of Barca being different in the Champions League?
A little bit, yeah. And he's on 7 goals this season, so he's the top scorer in the competition, which is more than he's got any season until this stage in any of the previous seasons, even though he's always ended up, I think, 3 years in a row now as top scorer with 9 and 8 and 12, I think it was, last season. So in that sense, yes, he looked very good. I also think, as I say, that there's a motivational thing. And when we talk about Messi looks at physically a tiny bit jaded, but there's also about, you know, the sharpness in terms of taking decisions, the sharpness in terms of the motivation in each game. And so yeah, maybe in a way Messi could be seen as the kind of the personification of that slight difference between Barcelona in the Champions League and Barcelona in La Liga. And Messi said the other day something which was quite interesting. He said, in the Champions League, use a Spanish phrase that's kind of quite common, as a bit of a cliche, we've changed the chip. In other words, we've changed the circuit board in our heads. And in the Champions League, we think about things in a different way because we recognise that La Liga is very hard now. That sounded a little bit to me like a player who says, OK, we can't win the league now.
We started this pod talking about how terrible Arsenal were last night. Rumours that Pep fancies a new challenge, and that might be at the Emirates. Do you know any more?
Well, Pep Guardiola is in a similar familiar situation in that virtually every January, February time, sometimes even as late as the very back end of February, Guardiola re-signs a new contract. And every year he only signs for 1 year. And he says that each time it's about being convinced that it's worth carrying on. It's about being convinced that this is a worthwhile project. And he hasn't yet signed. And every single year we seem to go through this, will he, won't he? And I'm not convinced that it does the team a huge amount of good, although I think Guardiola believes that if he just sort of immediately signed, or if he signed a three-year deal, the players would relax that little bit more, and he needs to try and keep the pressure up on them. I suspect he will end up signing that new contract now, so it's not necessarily an issue for right now. Although there's a certain degree of nerves at the moment, but I don't think there's too much doubt that in the long term, Guardiola will look to try and achieve something elsewhere, not just at Barcelona. And London, by the way, I think would be very high on his priority list.
All right, welcome to the final part of the pod, or part three, whichever you prefer. We'll look at the FA Cup in a second. Let's start with Carlos Tevez. Mancini kind of intimated that Tevez would have a chance if he was contrite and if he came in and apologised. Tevez came out yesterday or today saying, I was treated like a dog. I know someone here is going to say, look, some dogs are treated quite well. And, you know, there was that guy the other day who jumped into an icy brook to save his dog, but Tevez clearly didn't mean it like that. Is he ever going to play for City again?
Doesn't look like it, does it? I mean, the things that Mancini has said since is that I didn't treat him badly, I treated him too well. I mean, it sounds like with each passing interview, they're pushing themselves further apart.
There were some suggestions that, again, that the interview was relatively dubiously translated in the sense that he was talking in a sort of Buenos Aires slang dialect, if you like. But still, I think that's besides the point. I think the rhetoric was clear that he felt he'd been treated poorly. I also quite like how he kind of tried to, not blame, but put Dzeko in the spotlight to some extent, saying that he'd got Mancini really angry, and then Mancini kind of then took it out on him when he was just having, you know, a quiet chat with Zabaleta, which is kind of a bit underhand. But no, I don't think he'll play for City, even though he has come back.
I mean, Dzeko, I mean, if you're going to take on one of the City players, Dzeko looks a bit soft, doesn't he? You probably...
He's tall.
A bit soft, and yet 6'4", massive.
No, it's all relative. He'd definitely be able to beat me up. I'd totally take that on.
The thing about Tevez is that, you know, the city's goals have been drying up, and they've been they've gone back to kind of last year-like performances of durability. And if this continues, and if they get a couple of, you know, draws or what that they should have been expected to win, there's going to be a lot of clamour for Tevez, who was breaking those games last season, to come back into the pitch, and that will be the tricky time, I think.
I think the thing with the interviews to bear in mind is that there's some kind of a strange theatre going on for legal reasons, that both sides have to be shown to be wanting to play football. So it is really difficult to know, you know, how real Tevez is, even when he does sound slightly contrite, and how, you know, what Mancini's doing. Because I think what you can say about Mancini's management style is that it is very, very severe on players, even on players he does like. He just doesn't believe in this whole arm around your shoulder, go on, lads, kind of thing. He's just very, very businesslike. And some players, even on, you know, even when there's no problems, will react to that differently than others.
It's such a waste, isn't it?
What?
It's just, well, Tevez, you know, here's someone who's really good. Imagine being that good at football.
Yeah, but you know what?
I want to play.
But you know what the narrative will be? Because if he now comes back and they continue to struggle, then in 10 years' time we'll read that this was a City team destined to win the title, and when Tevez came back, it all fell apart.
Yeah, but you can't look at a hypothetical legacy, can you? I mean, I don't know how clever they all are.
I mean, you just wonder what damage he's done to his career long term. I mean, he was obviously hoping for a move out in January. It didn't happen, presumably because of the wage package that they were looking for. And if he, you know, acquits himself poorly, either doesn't get on the pitch or doesn't make a difference when he does, what are his prospects going to be like in the summer?
Well, maybe when Capello gets the Wolves job.
What I love is this suggestion that if City were to win the title, his wages would double. And that was one of the reasons, allegedly, why teams, you know, couldn't agree a straightforward deal with him, because
just the £500,000 a week.
Exactly. They didn't want that clause to be in there.
Can't get anything for these days.
But long term, City have a player on loan at Feyenoord at the moment called John Guidetti, who I think scored 3 hat tricks in 4 games. So
solid.
Long term, if they bring him back, then maybe they won't regret Carlitos leaving. But so there you go.
There we are. Right, let's talk about Huddersfield. We had a production meeting this morning, and Sean Ingle, who everyone listening will know, as well as saying on Monday's pod that Arsenal might sneak it past Milan, he suggested that Huddersfield had underachieved under Lee Clark.
That's going to be my line of argument, too.
Is it? Okay, yeah. Then, Paul, take it away.
Well, I don't want to step on James's toes here, because he is a Yorkshireman and may have more first-hand insight, but I've been kind of looking around the message boards and stuff and listening to what kind of Norwich fans have been saying about Lee Clark was our left Norwich for Huddersfield. He was our vice manager, or whatever the term is. Can't think of the accurate word.
Assistant manager.
That's it. And he left for his first proper job. And the feeling is that actually, admittedly, they lost Lee Peltier to Leicester in the summer and Anthony Pilkington went to Norwich. But he's been backed with budget. And they've been topping out on the wage bill to the extent that promotion is a necessity this season for Huddersfield, essentially. And they just haven't done it. They've kind of, I think it's 13 draws this season, and they've got 16 games to go. And one side of the argument says that the club have decided that they're not entirely sure that Lee Clark could deliver it. There's also not much support from the fans, who actually have, you know, despite the fact that Jordan Rhodes has been scoring goals for fun, haven't really been enjoying watching his team play. And that this,
everyone's expectation is crazy. You know, you've lost 3 games in 55.
But
I'm a Cambridge fan, but lots and lots of draws,
and playing for the draw rather than playing for the win. And people are saying, you know, people are even saying positive things about Steve Bruce in retrospect. And I think there's also the feeling that Clark was quite visibly angling for the Leeds job.
Well, that's where I come in, because
you are Leeds.
I am Leeds. Clark at the start of this month had come out and said that he wasn't particularly flattered by the interest from Leeds, which some people have suggested wouldn't enamour Ken Bates, who usually holds these things against coaches. But also, Leeds fans are quite lukewarm about the prospect of Clark taking the job. Because, as you say, his record... you have to give him respect for going unbeaten in regular season games, to use an Americanism, for so long. He hasn't been able to earn promotion, which is what Simon Grayson, his would-be predecessor, did. He got Leeds out of League One. And Leeds' ambitions, whether right or not, is to get into the Premier League. And they want arguably a coach who has that in their CV. Not necessarily a Warnock, although I think they'd be certainly more pro-Warnock than they are pro-Clark, or McCarthy as well, Mick McCarthy, because I think whether it's realistic or not to expect Leeds to challenge to get into the Premier League, they don't think Lee Clark is the man to do it, I don't think.
Will Ken Bates spend the money on the wages to get somebody like a Mick McCarthy in there?
Well, that's the thing. I think when he got rid of Grayson, he would have quite liked caretaker Neil Redfern to give him the excuse to give him the job, because he's a cheap option. But Redfern, after winning his first game against Bristol City 3-0, has lost 2 on the bounce. And I mean, there is a clamour for someone with Premier League credentials to come in. But again, sacking your manager when the transfer window is closed, knowing there's no money to spend, knowing your your top player will arguably be sold in the summer, as all Leeds top players have been sold in every transfer window of recent memory. While the club's a prestigious one to take over, you have to say who would want to take that job.
And actually, might there not be a better prospect of a club going forward if you went to Huddersfield?
Yeah.
Oh, ouch. That hurt as a Leeds fan.
Well, Huddersfield fans hate Leeds supporters for no real reason. There's not a lasting rivalry there, apart from, you know, geographical location, you know. So, but yeah. Blah.
Okay, well, on that blah, let's talk about the FA Cup fifth round. It's not a gripping set of fixtures, is it? Paul Lambert's Green and Yellow Army is the T-shirt that Paul McInnes has. Who have you got? You're home to Leicester.
Home to Leicester.
Do you think, I mean, you...
According to, there's a guy who I work with called Mark Bygraves, who's a picture editor and knows football inside out and upside down. And he says his the betting tips is the same, that Leicester might do us. There'll be a tough game for us. But I think we're now one win, two wins away from safety. I think now we put the, you know, I think we'll probably give it a good go. It'd be very exciting. Very exciting. We're rubbish in the cups. It'd be so exciting if we win.
It's hard to see where the upset's going to come. Chelsea, Birmingham, Everton, Blackpool. I suppose Millwall could beat Bolton. That's not an easy place to go.
Stevenage are a tough side. Stevenage are a very physical side, can play, and
they're playing Spurs.
Yeah, at home, in a kind of very odd, ramshackle ground with unique dimensions. They will stick it to Spurs. Spurs will probably play.
How unique are this trapezium? How unique are the
well, it's just kind of, I mean, what I mean is it's an uneven, lumpy pitch, really.
Okay.
But Spurs will probably put out a second string side, maybe even a third string side, because, you know, they've got a title race to be concentrating on.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, Spurs will win, but I think Stevenish could give them a good one for their money.
The pitch sounds like San Siro last night.
Well, indeed.
Finally, in exciting Italian news, have you seen this, James, or anyone seen this, that Alessandro Del Piero has revived a young lady from a coma?
Yeah, she went into a coma, I think, in January. Mm-hmm. While watching Juventus play with her dad. And
terribly boring game, was it?
Actually, they draw too much. You could say Antonio Conte is the Italian Lee Clark at the moment in time. But they got in touch with the foundation, who then subsequently got in touch with Del Piero, who recorded this message where he said, I've got it written down here. Ciao Giada, which is her name. I'm Alessandro Del Piero. I hope you wake up as soon as possible so you can watch many of our and my games. Come see us and above all, get to know us. And a few hours after hearing that message, apparently her hand moved. And then 24 hours later, she was calling for her mum and actually speaking.
Oh, I see. I have it. My news is within days she began to stir, as if it's sort of completely tenuously crazy. 6 years later.
This, again, embellishes his sort of Del Piero's sort of good guy, can't do a thing wrong reputation, which, to be fair, he can't. So, yeah, again, as he's set to leave Juventus at the end of the season, I think it's again, another part of his legacy is this.
It's a beautiful story.
Beautiful guy.
If there was a footballer you wanted to wake you up, if you were in a coma?
Peter Crouch.
Okay.
No need to explain that. Like, everybody knows why.
Batistuta, I'd quite like to not wake up next to him. But yeah, he's got similar longer hair. He likes polo. I don't like polo. But yeah, swinging a bat around on a horse. Stuff like that.
Whereas Peter Crouch looks like he's got polio. So there you go. Mm.
I prefer Birgit Prince.
Prince?
Birgit Prince.
Oh, Birgit Prince.
I thought you said bearded some Prince. Culture, I thought he's always had a beard.
You definitely wouldn't want Prince to wear your back.
Well,
would
I
you?
Don't know.
Thank you, Paul McInnes.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you very much, Rafa Herningstein.
Thank you.
Thank you, James Horncastle.
Thank you, Max.
And producer Ben would like us to finish on not singing this time, but words of wisdom from your grandfather.
Yeah, in light of the ponytails on show at the Milan game yesterday. I have long hair. I've never considered having a ponytail because my grandpa always said that what's under a ponytail? An arsehole. It's true.
James is back on Monday. I didn't mean it like that.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.